This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Alan Cumming, is starring in the new Broadway revival of the musical Cabaret. Cumming has starred in Cabaret three times: a 1993 London production, the 1998 Broadway revival for which he won a Tony, and the new revival that opened last week. He plays the MC in a Berlin nightclub of debauchery called the Kit Kat Club in 1929 and 1930, as the Nazis are slowly emerging and no one yet knows how powerful they will become. The role of the MC was originated by Joel Grey, who starred in the original 1966 Broadway production as well as the 1972 movie. Each of the productions with Cumming was directed by Sam Mendes. Rob Marshall choreographed both American productions and also co-directed the new one. Alan Cumming's interview with Terry aired Monday, and they began with a song from the new production by the Roundabout Theater Company, the same company that produced the 1998 Tony Award-winning production.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, Guten Abend, Bonsoir, Good Evening, Wie geht's, comment ça va, do you feel good? Yeah, I bet you do. Ich bin euer Compensia, je suis votre compère. I am your host. Und sage willkommen, bienvenue, welcome.
Alan Cumming, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations. You're so wonderful in the show. It's so terrific.
Thank you, Teddy.
Thank you for coming. You've said, I think, that this revival was your birthday present to yourself. What does that mean? Did you initiate the idea of reviving it again?
No, I didn't. But it was Sam Mendes who called me up a few years ago. And there's been sort of various attempts to redo it or to put it on since it ended. I did it for a year from 98 to 99, and it actually finished, I think, in 2004 on Broadway. But anyway, so a few years ago, Sam said, you know, I think it's a good time. The rights are going to be up, and so therefore someone else will do it, and, you know, maybe the estate wants us to do our production again. And I just sort of thought it would be, and the thing about the birthday is that I'm 49, and so I'll be 50 in January 27th next year. And so in my 50th year, I am singing and dancing in a Broadway musical, and I'm dancing a kick line with, you know, girls who are 24. And so that was kind of the birthday present to myself, that I would be hitting 50, doing things that I couldn't do when I was, you know, 25.
Oh, that is nice. You couldn't kick like that? Or they just didn't have the opportunity?
I was so out of shape and unfit when I was 25. I think even when I did it 15 years ago, I wasn't as fit as I am now.
So why do you love doing the role?
Well, I mean, just on a day-to-day, going to work and doing that, it's such fun. It's, you know, so kind of energetic. It just takes up every single element of being an actor. It's your body is used to its capacity, both, you know, physically, vocally, and emotionally as well. But also in a kind of larger way, I think it's a really important show, in that the reason it's done again, the reason we're doing it again, is that it has something to say. You know, it's about the rise of Nazism, and the fact that if you're not incredibly vigilant, oppression of some kind can slowly creep up and take over. And I think that the way that the show is like fun, and you just, oh, it's sexy and they're hilarious and oh, and blah, blah. And then it slowly goes dark. You, as an audience member, have kind of become complicit in that. And that sort of mirrors the way that you see Nazism creeping in, and people think, oh, it'll be fine, don't worry, it'll go away. And then slowly it doesn't, and it's too late.
I would like you to describe your character physically, what you're wearing, what your hair looks like.
Well, initially, I have jet black hair right now, which is not natural, Terry, I'll confess. So I have jet black hair, sort of, you know, late 1920s, kind of floppy on top, short at the back and the sides. The first costume I wear is, I wear a leather coat, but I shortly take that off. And I've got kind of like a black dinner suit trousers, but they're cut at the knees. A pair of big combat boots, and this kind of strappy thing, a kind of like suspenders. You know, it's almost like I'm topless, but I've got the suspender thing with a little bow tie at my chest, at my what do you call that bit in the middle of it? Sternum, and then kind of it's almost like a cantilever system to hike up my manhood, if you will.
Yes, your manhood is kind of like italicized in the.
It's in bold.
It's in bold letters. Yes.
It's sort of like a wonder bra for the male junk.
What is your take on the host, the MC that you play, and the club, the Kit Kat Club that you're in? Do you have a backstory for him in your mind?
I'll tell you my sort of very slim backstory. He was a rent boy, a boy from the streets of Berlin, who then kind of, you know, started working this club and was kind of funny. And so he got kind of, as he got a bit older, got a job. And the Kit Kat Club is basically a den of iniquity. It's got a little show. But there's kind of, you know, sex going on, there's drugs going on. It's a very low-life kind of place. So that's basically all my story for this man. He used to be, you know, he has a background as a sex worker who then becomes, who you can sing a bit. And I don't know his name. I don't know where he, you know, I actually don't think that's important. I don't worry about that. Because there's a larger, broader, more overreaching thing about this character. He's kind of like this. He guides the audience. He's like a puppeteer almost, or a sort of a Pied Piper, if you like, who takes the audience on this journey, kind of tells them what to think at certain times, guides them into certain things, and then ultimately, because he's got their trust, can betray that trust or also make them worry for him and for what's going on in the show. So it's almost like a sort of a Brechtian character of standing outside the story and commenting on it as it's happening.
You've portrayed this character in three separate versions of this Sam Mendes production. First, when you were 28 years old in 1993, then when you were 33 years old in 1998, and now when you're 49 years old in 2014.
And next time.
And I've seen the new production, and I've seen excerpts of both of the other productions. And there's things that are very similar. One of the differences is that, you know, you've gotten older. And I think that changes the character. You know, the rent boy turned MC in this kind of seedy club at age 28 is different from that same character at age 49. Because that character hasn't made it out of that club. Still there at age 49. So in that sense, he becomes kind of even darker.
I think that's absolutely true. I think this production of the production is darker, partly because I'm older and because the sort of sex element of the show, the sensationalist kind of thing in 1998 when we came to America was so shocking and took up so much of people's perception of the whole show, was this, you know, depiction of sexual freedom and hedonism and gay sex and bisexuality and all sorts of things that I think in a way took over a little too much. And now I think, you know, partly because of that production but partly because the world has changed, that is still an element. It's still fun. It's still very much part of what the story is about, but it doesn't overshadow everything. And also it has allowed the kind of darkness to come out a little bit more.
You know, in speaking about the sexuality of this production, it's sexualized in a different way than, say, the movie Cabaret, which I think a lot of people are familiar with. In the movie version of Cabaret, Joel Grey starred in the role of the MC, of the host. And I think he played it kind of, he's great in it. And I think he played it kind of like a ringmaster in a circus of sexual deviance. And I think deviance is what they would have been called at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to use a word from the period. And you play it like you are sexually seducing us into your kind of debauched world.
I mean, I feel like I feel like I'm saying, you know, the gesture I do at the very beginning of the show is my finger. I am going, come here, come here, come here. And that's, I think, a sort of overriding metaphor for what I think that character does. And he's going, come on, come on, you know you want to, and it's going to be fun. And then, of course, and the audience does want to, and they do come. And then, of course, that's when they become complicit in the whole horror.
Alan Cumming speaking with Terry last Monday. Cumming stars in the new Broadway revival of Cabaret. Here he is in the 1998 cast recording performing the song Money.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round.
Money, 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 money.
If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ding-a-ling for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover, though you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, of that we can be sure. I'm being poor.
Money, 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 money.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Alan Cumming. He's starring in the new revival of Cabaret as the MC of the Kit Kat Club, a decadent nightclub in Berlin in 1929 and 1930, as the Nazis are beginning to gain power. It's Cumming's third time in that role. He also starred in the 1993 London revival and the 1998 Broadway production by the Roundabout Theatre Company, which also produced the new revival.
So the character that you play in Cabaret is very sexually ambiguous. I mean, in terms of sexual orientation, gay, bisexual, who knows? into everything, as I think.
Yeah.
whatever he wants it. You came out as bisexual, I think, the same year that Cabaret was revived in the United States in 1998, with you starring in it. And you've been married for how long? You have a husband.
I have a husband. I've been married to him for, since 2007. So
right.
7 years.
So did you time coming out with the production of Cabaret?
It was all a huge press campaign. It was all a massive Machiavellian
clever
plot. No,
That's the point of sexuality, actually.
Power.
Yeah.
Kind of is. What I think you're getting at, I'll give you a little place here that I hope will answer your question. I've always felt I was bisexual. I used to be married to a woman. Before that, I'd had a relationship with a man. I then had another relationship with a woman. And then since then, I've had, relationships with men. So I still would define myself as bisexual, partly because that's what I feel, but also because I think it's important to... I think that sexuality in this country especially is very seen as a very black and white thing. And I think we should encourage the grey. I don't go around in my life thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have sex with a woman soon because I said I was bisexual. That's what I feel inside. It's like saying you're straight or you're gay or you're bisexual. It's just what you are. And whatever you're doing in your life is almost, it runs obviously parallel, but it's kind of secondary to how you are inside. And so that's how I've always felt, and I still do, even though, I'm very happily married to a really amazing man, and I wish to be so for the rest of my life. The other thing is that the coming out thing, in 1998, when I came to America, there was such a huge explosion of interest in the show and in me, and I hadn't really, I was kind of well-known in Britain, but I hadn't really ever discussed my sexuality in a public way like that. And because of playing this character and all the kind of slight, puritanical shockwaves that were sending around America, a lot of people were just constantly asking me about it. And so I decided to take matters into my own hand, and I did a an interview and a cover story for Out magazine, and I thought that was a good forum for it to be discussed calmly and adultly. And so I did that. So it was kind of as a result of all the speculation and but it was really funny. I remember people saying, so the first question in an interview for some, like, you know, weighty tome would be, so are you gay? And I would go, why, do you fancy me? And then go, oh no, just someone in my office was asking. And I was like, oh really? Well, you know, I thought, really, is that the most important thing? And sometimes it is the most important thing, because people can't, if people don't have a black and white answer, they can't get beyond that. And so you have to kind of, I think you just got to get out of the way. And that's what I did. And it wasn't like it's one of those things, when you become famous and people are more interested in your personal life often than your work, it's a weird thing, because you think, oh, I seem to be sleeping with more boys now. Should I do a press release? You know, it's a really difficult one to know when to announce.
Were you afraid that if you didn't say something yourself that you'd be outed in a really nasty way by somebody trying to hurt you and not realizing, you know, it's not like it's a bad thing, but people reveal secrets in nasty ways.
Yeah, I thought that I was actually, one of the other reasons was I was having a relationship with a man for the first time. I mean, well, aside from like someone at college, I was living with a man for the first time, and I was just really worried that he and his family and my family were going to be harassed by the British press, actually. So, because I had been harassed in the previous relationship I'd had with a woman, you know, I saw some really nasty things happening. And so I just wanted to avoid that again.
So yeah. Let me just ask you one other question about sexual orientation. You're
bashing on at this one, Terry.
No. Here's the question. You describe yourself as bisexual. Does that make some people angry? Like, no, you have to decide. You're really gay, aren't you? Or you know what I mean? People want.
Yes, I think it does. I mean, I think there's that. I think it's slightly. I mean, I say sometimes I just say I'm gay. Sometimes I. You know, if I'm having a conversation with an adult like you, an intelligent person like you, I try and talk about it in this way, and I explain why I define myself in that way. But if you know, I'm called gay or queer or something all the time, I'm perfectly happy with that. But when I have my druthers, that's how I would describe it. I mean, I think the idea that people say, oh, you're just really gay, you're afraid to say it, that doesn't apply in my case. You know, hi, I'm incoming, I'm gay. There you go. For me, I think I want to push the idea that, you know, bisexuality is not something that's just a transitionary state to becoming homosexual, or, you know, that you help out when they're busy, sort of thing. I'm glad you got that. Not many Americans get that gag.
So here's a very intellectual question I wanted to ask you. You'll appreciate the depth of this. In a lot of your choreography and cabaret, your arms are raised over your head. You did not shave under your arms. I don't know what the protocol is for men now. Like, men defoliate their chests, like, you know, for movies.
Yes.
So I don't know what the story is supposed to be for under your arms. I worked really hard
Teddy
on that
gross.
Question.
Teddy gross. I'm appalled. Well, you notice the girls don't shave under their arms either.
I didn't notice that. Oh, no,
yeah,
I didn't
the girls
notice
have
that.
To, the girls have got to have hairy armpits. That was part of the, you know, the down and dirty thing of the club. I have extensive hair under my arms. I'm aware of that. I have, it's actually annoying because
I've seen more. It's really not, yeah, go ahead.
But it's not, I mean, I'm not a hairy person. I've longed to have a hairy chest. I mean, I have. I have a little kind of tuft in my sternum. Gosh, I've said sternum twice in this interview. I don't think I've said sternum for years before this. But I have a little tuft there. And then I've got odd ones across my chest. And I remember when my dad got a hairy chest. You know, I was old enough to think, oh, he suddenly got a hairy chest. He was probably in his 30s or something. And I'm now nearly in my 50s. And it hasn't happened. But I seem to have all my hair in my armpits. And actually, it seems to cause great consternation to people. I did a thing for the Scottish Independence campaign. I did a photo and with it on Twitter, and this hashtag is Go For It Scotland. It's a thing to encourage people that are, you know, who are not able to vote in the independence referendum to sort of just show their support. So I started this thing, and I was holding a sign up saying Go For It Scotland, and you saw my armpit hair, I had a sleeveless thing on. God, more people talked about my armpit hair than about the actual issue of independence, which kind of defeated the purpose a wee bit. But I don't know. I trim them sometimes, but I actually really, just as a sort of side point, if you're going to, you know, ask a silly question, I'm going to say a thing about it. I think this obsession we have in our culture with shaving, taking away body hair, like on men and women, I think is really dangerous. And it's sort of like wanting to infantilize yourself and wanting to kind of, you know, make something sexy that is not adult. It's more sort of prepubescent. And I think that's really weird and dangerous, don't you?
I do, actually. Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome.
So we are recording this on Thursday, April 24th, and tonight is your opening night.
That's right.
So what does that mean? Like, are you nervous now? I can't believe you're doing this interview now. I'm so happy that you were able to come today. But so are you nervous? You've been doing this for weeks in rehearsal. And
yeah, we've been previewing for a month. You know, mm-hmm. we've done like, I mean
previews. I mean previews. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So no, I mean, like, last night I was like, oh, you know, our fate is sealed. And it sort of, it's been a bit like Groundhog Day, because you just kind of, you're in this state where, you know, tomorrow all the reviews will come out, all the kind of, you know, it's just been announced we're extending until January and all that stuff. And tonight is really, I mean, it's kind of nerve-wracking because it's the big, the kind of, ta-da, here we are. But actually, all the people in the audience are your friends and your agents, and who are your friends as well often. And
the critics.
No, the critics are not in tonight. The critics now, the critics come actually, you know, for, actually probably when you were there, there was critics in. They come like over a period of like three or four nights.
I was there for previews. I thought critics weren't allowed to review.
No, they come, well, towards the end of previews, they come in, and then so that on the, it's different how they do it here in America, that in London, like when you do a play in the West End, like the first night is like full of critics. Like you can actually see them with their, when you're on stage, you can see them with their little notepads. You can even hear them sometimes scribbling away in their bitter little fashion. But in America, they come, they're spread out over three or four nights. I mean, on Broadway anyway. So all the critics have been. And so tonight it's just this big celebration. And then we have a party. And then, you know, you've got to do press and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, sort of fun, but actually the thing that I, last time when I did it, it was so overwhelming for me, the whole experience, all this stuff, that this time around I feel like I can enjoy it more because I understand what's going to happen. I understand that tonight is like going to be a bit like speed dating. I'm going to just, seriously, I'll be like, hi, oh, thank you so much. Oh, a photo, yes, yeah, sure. Hi, oh, thank you, oh, that's lovely. A photo, yes, yeah, sure. Like that. So, you know, and then eventually a time comes when I say, could we have the security around me? I don't want to talk to anyone else. I'm just going to have a wee drink with my friends. And, you know, so I understand. I feel like I'm an old pro now and I can do what I have to do, but also draw the line and say, now I'm going to have some fun.
Alan Cumming, this was so much fun. And congratulations on your performance. It is so good.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm a big fan and it was lovely to talk to you.
Alan Cumming spoke with Terry Gross last Monday. Cumming is starring in the Broadway revival of Cabaret by the Roundabout Theater Company. Godzilla is one of the most famous modern movies, but most people in the U.S. have never seen it in its original form. When it was first released in America in 1956, it was supplemented by new footage with the Hollywood actor Raymond Burr. In 2004, the original Japanese version was released to theaters and is now available on DVD from the Criterion Collection. Now, for the monster's 60th anniversary, Rialto Pictures is giving theatrical distribution to a new digital restoration of the film, complete with new subtitles. Seeing Godzilla again, our critic at large, John Powers, says it makes him nostalgic for old monster movies.
There have been hundreds of monster movies over the years, but only a handful of enduringly great movie monsters. And of those, only two were created for the screen. King Kong, the giant ape atop the Empire State Building, and his Japanese heir Godzilla, the city-flattening sea monster who's a genuinely terrific pop icon. He not only stars in movies, Hollywood is bringing out a new Godzilla on May 16th, but he's even played basketball with Charles Barkley in a commercial for Nike. It's been exactly 6 decades since Godzilla first hit the screen. And to celebrate the big guy's birthday, Rialto Pictures is releasing in theaters Ishiro Honda's 1954 original in a restored 60th anniversary edition. I've seen Godzilla many times since I was a kid, but watching it again, I was struck that it might be the best single film about the terrors of the nuclear age. I suspect you know the plot. It begins when American H-bomb tests in the Pacific disturb the watery environment that's the home of Gojira, as the monster's called in Japanese. After sinking assorted ships, this enormous beast winds up in Tokyo, where he stomps on buildings, flosses with power lines, and blasts citizens with his radioactive bad breath. When the army's unable to stop him, the only hope is a new invention called the Oxygen Destroyer. But its idealistic creator is reluctant to reveal it for fear it will become a weapon. Just look at the destruction that followed from splitting the atom. Yet even as the inventor says this, the movie itself is offering us the seductive spectacle of violent ruin. And make no mistake, destruction is great to look at. There's an amoral pleasure to be had in watching Godzilla reduce Tokyo to fiery rubble, rather like the beauty of seeing those napalmed palm trees flare like matches in Apocalypse Now, or the illicit thrill of seeing the White House get obliterated in Independence Day, before 9/11, of course. Quite clearly, it's this joy in destruction that helped make Godzilla influential, especially in Hollywood, which over the last half century has fed the worldwide audience's appetite for images of spectacular violence. That said, Godzilla's real strength lies not in its effects, impressive for the time, but in its underlying emotional and cultural seriousness. It's not simply that the music is often doleful rather than exciting, or that we see doomed children set off Geiger counters. The movie has a gravity that comes from being created in a Japan that knew what it was to have children die from radiation poisoning and to see its capital city in flames. Both drawn to and terrified of the monster's power, the movie's steeped in Japan's traumatic historical experience. It has weight. It means something. Godzilla's resonance is also inseparable from something else that once defined the best monster movies, a sense of compassion for the monster. Boris Karloff's Frankenstein may have been scary, but we also felt his frailty and fear of being hunted. King Kong was dangerous, sure, but his eyes were charged with almost human feeling when he gazed at Fay Wray. The same is true of Godzilla, who starts out wreaking havoc, but by the film's end, takes on a melancholy, sad-faced grandeur. These days, our pop culture doesn't encourage such identification. Ever since Jaws and Alien and Predator, whose creatures are ruthless murder machines, our monsters have increasingly become soulless things to be destroyed. Consider today's favorite monster, the zombie. Although zombies could hardly seem more human, heck, they just were human. The Walking Dead have no individuality, and they run in packs. They basically exist to have their heads shot off in movies and TV shows that resemble video games. Godzilla is not remotely like this. In his wonderful short story, Gojira, King of the Monsters, Jim Shepard offers a fictionalized account of the making of the movie. At one point, Shepard has director Ishiro Honda explain why the vanquishing of Godzilla feels so sad. And his words sum up brilliantly what gives Godzilla its strange power. By the time the movie ends, Honda says, Godzilla is like a hero whose departure we regret. It's like part of us leaving. That's what makes it so hard. The monster the child knows best is the monster he feels himself to be.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue Daily. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Matthew Weiner, is at work writing and shooting the final episodes of AMC's Mad Men. He's the creator of Mad Men, as well as an executive producer, writer, and director of the show. Weiner spoke with Terry last Thursday. The final season, which began April 13th, is divided in half, with the second half to be shown next year. If you watch Mad Men but aren't caught up, you might want to listen to this after you've watched the episode that was shown last Sunday. It's now 1969 on Mad Men, and we're seeing the consequences of what Don Draper and his advertising agency, Sterling Cooper and Partners, did at the end of last season. The partners forced Don to take a leave of absence after he chose the wrong time to tell the truth about his past. He and some of his partners were at a pitch meeting with representatives from Hershey Chocolate, an important prospective client. Don delivered a heartwarming pitch, drawing on his childhood memory of how his father would reward him for mowing the lawn by taking him to the drugstore and letting him buy anything. Don would choose a Hershey bar and forever equated Hershey with his father's love. The folks from Hershey liked that. Then Don told the truth, the secret about his past that shocked everyone in the room.
I was an orphan. I grew up in Pennsylvania. In a whorehouse. I read about Milton Hershey and his school in Coronet magazine or some other crap the girls left by the toilet. And I read that some orphans had a different life there. I could picture it. I dreamt of it. Of being wanted. Because the woman who was forced to raise me would look at me every day like she hoped I would disappear. Closest I got to feeling wanted was from a girl who made me go through her John's pockets while they if I collected more than a dollar, she'd buy me a Hershey bar. And I would eat it. Alone in my room with great ceremony. Feeling like a normal kid. It said sweet on the package. Sweet thing in my life.
A scene from the conclusion of last season's Mad Men. Matthew Weiner, welcome back to Fresh Air. This season is great. It's so much fun to have you back on the air again. I'm so glad you are here.
Thank you so much, Terry. So, I'm so excited to be here.
Before we get to the new season, we have to talk about that Hershey bar scene. It was such a great way to show the difference between the public image of Don and the image, you know, the image Don's created for himself. And the real life that he's had, his real background. And it's also a great way to show how ads often present a very idealized image, not only of the product, but of who we are as consumers. How did you decide to have Don's kind of public confession about this and a kind of little mini breakdown be during an advertising pitch?
Well, I mean, that was the highest stakes. I mean, we all have secrets. And certainly a lot of the drama comes from the fact that Don is, there's a public Don and a private Don. And Don was back where he was and was forced to basically tell the truth. But who was there to tell? And to me, it was, you know, Cooper knows about him. Pete knows about him. Now his daughter knows about him in many ways. Betty knows about him. What is keeping him from having the self-esteem that matches the outside? And we sort of got him through alcohol and a series of disasters to a place where he had to tell it. And the middle of the pitch was the place to do it. And the idea was that Don would give a really good pitch right beforehand with the word love in it and the schmaltzy Hershey thing that actually became sort of their real campaign. But I love this idea that he had this personal association with it and that he would air this dirty laundry, and confession, you know, was good for the soul. It would be a moment of purity for him, which, of course, invites, you know, complete disaster.
You know, in the first pitch that he gives for the schmaltzy pitch that he gives for Hershey about how Hershey is love and everything, he talks right. about how his father used to give him a Hershey bar and tousle his hair. And I thought, like,
yeah.
Oh, that word tousle, that's one of the phoniest words. I mean, anytime somebody tousles someone's hair, it's just, it's going to be a cliche. And I think, oh, that was so perfect for, like, the cliche version.
Well, you know what? Part of the story of the show is who are the people who created this country? Who are these giants? And they have more stories like Don's than they do about having their hair tousled by their father.
So now we're into the final season. What makes writing this season different from writing all previous ones?
Well, the network has decided to split it over 2 years, so that's already different. I added an extra episode because I didn't want to have a 6-episode run. I mean, 7's going to feel short enough. And I had a plan with the writers for these 14 episodes that goes across them together, but there's going to be 10 months in between them on the air. So right away, I'm like, I need 2 premieres. I need 2 finales, really.
Mm.
It allowed for less digression, quite honestly. And I don't know how the audience feels about that, but when you're doing 13 episodes, you can investigate every corner of the story if you want to. You can follow anybody home. And this has made us really concentrate on the main characters. And it actually didn't seem like enough episodes for what we had to do. I'm writing episode 12 right now.
So no, you're still writing.
I've actually written the last 2. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Let's get to the new season. The new season opened with Freddie Rumson, who had been forced out of Sterling Cooper because of his alcoholism. It had become an embarrassment to himself and to the agency. He's sober now. And it opens with the camera on his face. His face fills the whole screen. And he's doing a pitch. We don't know who he's talking to, but eventually it becomes clear he's making this pitch to Peggy. He's testing it on her. Here we go.
Do you have time to improve your life? Do you have precisely 30 seconds for a word from Accutron watches? The watch appears, bottom third. The second hand moves with a fluid sweep, and above it, Accutron time. You go into a business meeting. Is there food in your teeth, ashes on your tie? And you've got nothing to say. The meeting is boring, but you can't be. But you're wearing an Accutron. This watch makes you interesting. It's a boardroom. It's black and white. We hear light traffic, no talking. We just see our man, you. Late 20s, shaggy, with a youthful colic, but in a suit and tie. This is a businessman, staring at his watch as muffled conversation swirls around him. Now we just hear the electronic hum. He stands up, and the faces come into view. A couple of white-haired men and a contemporary who looks like Steve McQueen. You shake hands, and Steve McQueen gets a look at your watch. We hear the first words. Is that Swiss? Now we're in color, and it's a little interview for the two of them while the other men look, outlining the benefits of this watch. It is Swiss. It is accurate. It is the height of design and technology. Accutron. It's not a timepiece. It's a conversation piece.
Wow, Freddie. That's a home run.
Okay. So that's the opening of this season of Mad Men. My guest, Matthew Weiner, is the creator of the show. So when I first heard this pitch, first of all, I was totally disoriented. Like, I didn't recognize Freddie at first, and I thought, who is he talking
right.
to? What is this about? What is going on? And then I started thinking, God, this is like a fake Don Draper pitch. And then I started thinking, yeah, it's kind of like overly poetic for a watch. It's like somebody trying to be Don Draper and not quite making it. And then at the end of the episode, of course, I find out, no, Freddie's just Don Draper's surrogate. It's really Don Draper wrote this pitch and gave it to Freddie because Draper is in exile and is persona non grata right now. And then I had to think, well, now we need to reconsider, is this a good pitch? And I don't even know what I think anymore. I've gone back and forth so much about whether this is a good pitch for Accutron or not. Tell me what you think.
Well, honestly, the interesting thing is Lou Avery's haircut on Peggy's idea, which is Accutron is accurate,
yes.
is actually what they used.
Oh, wait, really?
Used.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it might be a bit much. To me, we show the creative process as much as we can, which is the inspiration going through, you know. And I love the idea of Freddie, Joel Murray, telling a story and sort of breaking the fourth wall and looking into the camera. And I wanted it to be a little jarring and a little disorienting, and I wanted to open with an ad. And whether his language is poetic or not, there's a certain amount of salesmanship that goes into selling the idea to the immediate audience. They're selling it to the client, and then they're selling it to the consumer, and those are two different things. So his intensity and enthusiasm alone was supposed to be kind of jarring. But what I really wanted to do was talk about, I guess, that objects sort of define who you are, and talk about time, and grab your attention with with what was a very pure, whether it's good or bad, piece of advertising. And I don't know where to come down on it, whether it's good or bad, but that's sort of been the fun on the show. I think, you know, a lot of the ads they do aren't good, and they become good. And, you know, I have my own feelings about what a good ad is. The only measure in the end is, you know, what sells the product. And, you know, believe it or not, Ring Around the Collar is like, you know, the A-plus of that.
So let's get to another scene from this season of Mad Men, and my guest Matthew Weiner sure. is the creator of the show. Don Draper has been out in the cold. He's in exile from his own agency. And he sets up a dinner where he's offered an offer from another ad agency. He brings that offer and shows it to Roger and kind of gets Roger to invite him to come back on Monday. But Roger neglects to tell anyone at the agency that Don is coming back. So Don shows up. No one knows what he's doing there. No one seems particularly happy to see him. And he's sitting at the table with the creatives in the department, just like waiting for hours. And finally, he gets the meeting with – what happens is that Roger has to convince the partners to let Don come back. And this is the scene where Don walks into the office with all of the partners. Don Draper speaks first.
Sorry if I disrupted your day, but I've had a productive time catching myself up with everything.
Well, we've discussed it and we've reached the conclusion that we'd like you to come back to work.
I'm pleased to hear that.
But there are some stipulations.
Violation of which will result in termination and a reabsorption of your partnership shares.
You are not allowed to be alone with clients. You are to stick to the script in meetings, and that means the script will be approved by the people in this room.
Outside of client hospitality, there will be no drinking in the office.
You'll be in Lane's old office.
And you will report to Lou. Okay.
Wow. So, Matthew Weiner, I see this as like Don knowing he needs to be punished, and this is the sentence that he's been given. Tell me what you think.
You'll have to watch.
Okay.
I can just tell you one thing.
I will
certainly
watch.
It's certainly humbling, as was that whole experience being in the office there. I mean, I hope everyone's wondering what he's up to, if he is planning to have a trial by fire and earn it, or if he's up to some kind of scheme, or I don't know what they're thinking. I just knew that he had to get to the bottom of that thing, and get to the bottom of his job at that agency. I mean, when he goes and asks Roger, he tells him, "I've been offered this great job elsewhere," and he says, "I started that company, and you know, I basically don't want to abandon it." And Roger says, "Well, I miss you," and it's that easy. And then, of course, it's not that easy. And Don saying, "I've changed," or "I want to come back," or "I've been away," or "I did what you said," is not going to be enough. And so what okay means is sort of the story of what goes on in the show from here on.
Oh.
But I mean, it's definitely a humbling moment that should show you that in some way he has changed.
So one of the ultimate questions I think you're asking in this final season of Mad Men is a person truly capable of change? Does the truth redeem you? Is somebody who's done as much harm to other people as Don has done, intentionally or unintentionally, is a person like that capable of redemption? So I just wonder what kind of existential questions you've been asking yourself as you've written the final episodes.
Believe it or not, that is a big part of it. And to really get too in-depth in it will kind of reveal what's happening, although who knows, maybe it wouldn't. But, you know, I am finishing the show while we are moving Don in this pathway. And those two things are not lost on me. I have a birthday the day after we wrap. It's 49. My oldest son, who's on the show, is going off to college in the fall. there's a lot happening at once as the show ends. And so what I've been thinking about is sort of like, what is the substance of your life? Who are the people you make a difference with? What is your job? You know, at what point do you start looking at yourself in an honest way? Is change possible is a big part of it, you know? There's been a lot of apologizing going on in the show, and Don certainly owes people apologies, but how people behave to your change is sometimes the thing that keeps you from changing. So the existential questions are like, you know, Don, we talked about this once before, actually, that I feel like Don's sort of like, there are no rules, I'm living like there's no tomorrow, that whole thing, it's gotten old as he's gotten older. And now he's sort of starting to think about, what are the relationships that I value? How can I, what kind of person am I? And I guess I'm going to be leaving these characters in a place where they belong, and I'm trying to take Don on a journey that will help you understand something about him. I don't know if it reflects on you.
Listen, I would love to talk more, but I promised to let you go. And just tell me, okay, am I letting you go so that you can write or shoot today? What are you doing this week? Are you writing and shooting? Or
I finished episode 12 last night. We are shooting episode 10 right now. I'm going to go to a sound mix for episode 6.
Wow.
And then I'm going to stop in the writer's room and spend 4 hours trying to get the story right for episode 13 so I can send Carly Rae off to write the draft.
Oh, you'd better get going.
It's a lot. No, it's all good. It's all good. I work all days of the weekend, and you know, eventually I'm going to have you do an interview with me and my family so we can get reacquainted.
Okay, well, I really can't wait to see what you do next on Mad Men,
okay,
and good luck with the rest of the series. Thank you so much for coming back.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Terry. Bye-bye.
Matthew Weiner spoke with Terry last Thursday. Weiner is the creator of Mad Men, which airs Sundays on AMC. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculi.